I don't know about you, if you enjoy stargazing. I don't know if, quick raise a hand, who's been stargazing before? One of the most memorable moments of my life was at the same time that I got saved, a group of us went outside of the building that we were in. We were in northern Wisconsin at a camp called Camp Lake Ellen. No, this is not Camp Lake Ellen. I did not take this picture, sadly. I should say I did take it from Google, but I did not take the picture. But what we saw that night, it didn't obviously change what was going on in my heart in relation to who God was and how great and awesome he was, but it confirmed a lot of what I had said and done and heard that night. It was very memorable. There's at least three things that stood out on why that night of stargazing was so significant. It was the first time I saw multiple shooting stars. I don't know if you've seen a shooting star, but growing up in Northwest Indiana, right outside Chicago, there are not a lot of shooting stars. And when we think they're shooting stars, like, that's an airplane. Never mind. Scratch that. Still no shooting stars. But we saw multiple of those. That was cool. And the second thing that stood out was in the first service, I called it a comet. I was graciously corrected. It's a meteor. Meteor. And for what's the difference, comets go around the sun. Meteor are the ones that eventually sometimes pass by Earth or go into the atmosphere. We saw one, which was awesome. And it's better than a shooting star because it's bigger, it's brighter, it's colorful, and it lasts longer. It'll leave like a little trail of dust, and it's like a bright neon blue, kind of like the center of where those stars are. But the third thing that stood out that night in stargazing was that band that's kind of going at an angle in the middle of that picture. If you don't know what that is one of the spirals of the Milky Way galaxy. The galaxy is consisted of, it depends on, there's about three major spirals that go out from it, and each one has about 1 to 200 billion stars. So how many stars are right there in that picture? Really quick, count them if you can. Just kidding, you can't do that. But what there is probably just in this picture alone is anywhere 50 to 100 billion stars. It was just breathtaking, absolutely breathtaking. But what made it so bright that night? What allowed all of those things to be able to come more clearly and see it in ways that I've never seen it since, and I hadn't seen it before? Well, in the physical realm, just like the spiritual realm, lights shine brightest when the sky seems the darkest. God has allowed it, physically and spiritually, the stars that he owns, if you will become more bright when placed against the backdrop of the darkest night, which is why Chicago, probably you don't see a lot of shooting stars, because there's so many lights and there's so much pollution, there's too much in between what you want to see. And what I want to look at is from Judges chapter 2, how we can look at them and how to shine in the darkness. It shouldn't take long for us to conclude we live in a dark world. If you consider it politically, it doesn't take any more than the last election to realize how much just anti-God mentality there is in the nation. Even on Guam, there's a lot of things that we'll see and that we'll hear. It's clear that their burden is not to exalt God and lift up his word and his truth. Entertainment, it doesn't take long to find entertainment that just is marked by evil or darkness rather than it is truth. And even if you just take society as a whole, just in general, how much violence there ends up happening, even if it's just the mass amount of shootings that have happened over the last number of years, it doesn't take long to paint a dark picture of the world around us. So what did it look like for God's people to shine his lights during that dark time? If you're at 1 Corinthians 10, we're gonna get somewhat more of a reason why we should look at Judges, okay? Because if you know anything about Judges, you'll know that they did not shine bright. If anything, that would be the last book that we should go to figure out how we should live as a representative of God. But if you're wondering, why did we choose Judges to talk today when we could have chosen any other book? Well, number one, we're talking about Ruth next week. We're starting a multiple-part series on the book of Ruth, which is very much a bright spot in the dark times of Israel's history. But Ruth 1:1, if you'll listen, it says, "It came to pass that in the days when the judges ruled, that there's a famine in the land." In other words, if you want to know and feel the weight and the gravity of Ruth, you have to put yourself in the landscape of the judges. And so what I want to do today is to get a survey, if you will, of what the life in Israel during the time of judges was like. But even so, you may be thinking, yeah, but that's not for me. You don't have to tell me not to do what the judges did. I already know. And what does Judges have anything to do with me? Well, look at verse 11 of 1 Corinthians 10. It begins by talking about all the things that they did where they failed. It talks about lusting, talks about committing sexual immorality, tempting, complaining. But then there's a phrase where it says they became idolaters. All of these things are describing exactly what the judges were doing. So that's, we know that that's the people they're talking about. Then look what it says in verse 11. All these things happened to them as examples for us. We look at them as examples, all right? Just like a figure, as a sculpture. If you, when you see a sculpture, you'll know some things about that person. When we look at the Old Testament, we see judges, it's a sculpture, maybe a not good-looking one, but we'll know some things that characterize them. And then notice what it says after that. Not only were they an example, but they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Verse 12, it says this, "Therefore, let him who thinks that he stands take heed, lest he fall." So if you find yourself at a point where you don't think judges can relate to you, and that you don't think you'd be tempted in the same way as them, what Paul is saying is that me and everyone else in the world is going to be tempted in the same way. And we have it written for our admonition that we might take heed so that we don't fall in that same way. So what are the ways that the judges failed, that Israel failed? There are four keys that I think we can pull out from Judges chapter 2. If you're not there, why don't you turn with me now to Judges 2. And we're going to be pulling out mostly from verses 11 all the way to 18. But a quick background, three things really quick, and then we'll jump into our major outline. It takes place between Joshua and David. All of you have heard of David. I'm guessing most, if not all of you, have heard of Joshua. Joshua came right after Moses. They were freed from Israel in the wilderness for 40 years. They get to the brink of the promised land, and they can't go in. Moses was never able to get them into the land. God's plan was a man named Joshua to get them into the land. And that's really important to know because for us, it's the same way. The law, the New Testament says, gets us to the point where we realize we have sin, but it can never get us into a life relationship with Jesus. It can't. It was never intended to. All it did is get us to the point of salvation in God. But Jesus, which is just the New Testament name for Joshua, is the one that gets us into the land. And so for if there's a picture, a New Testament picture of what is happening in the Old Testament, it is us in this room. We who have placed their faith and trust in Christ have gone into the promised land of eternal life. We've received our inheritance, if you will. And what happens to the judges is an exact picture of what happens to us. Namely, that we, so what we're going to see is kind of a step-by-step picture of what can happen to us in our lives. So that's when it takes place. One of the issues, the darkness came is because there was no qualified leadership in place. And we're going to look at how that impacted them. But the third thing, the biggest issue is in Judges 17. You don't have to turn there because you know the phrase or you've heard it before if you know anything about Judges. It says this, "In those days, there was no king, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. I don't know if you've heard of the movie called The Purge. Would not recommend it. The premise is what is happening in Judges, though. The idea of this movie is there is no laws whatsoever. You can do whatever, whenever, to whoever you want. Doesn't matter. And what we see in Judges is that every person did whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted, to whoever they wanted, because of whatever reason they wanted to. And the purpose of the movie is to show how corrupt people really are and can be. And in some ways, in many ways, Judges does that same exact thing. And so what I want us to see is two things. How they failed to use these keys of shining in darkness, and how we can flourish by using these keys of shining in darkness. And so without further ado, there's going to be four keys. Key number one, the first thing is that they didn't do is they never acknowledged the source of darkness. They never acknowledged the source of darkness. Notice in chapter 1, actually, we see a phrase that's repeated in chapter 1. It says in verse 19, it says they could not drive out the people of the land. But then 21 says something different. 21 says this, and this is the phrase that's repeated. It says, Benjamin did not drive out the people of the land. That phrase, did not drive out, is repeated 9 times. It goes through almost every tribe of Israel, saying that when they tried to go to advance and to get full blessing of their inheritance, going through the land, take full ownership, and just be totally committed to God, it said that they didn't do something. And this first thing you can call, they tolerated evil. They tolerated evil. They had one job. One job. Just get rid of the people who are going to, and the things, not just the people, the things that will draw you from a close walk with God. Just get rid of it. You will not enjoy the full benefit of your inheritance if you allow these things to stay. And so while some of them, they couldn't drive them out, everyone else, it says, they would not. And so here you have Israel at the brink of they're inside the land and they're failing to experience the blessings of dedication, of commitment, of joy and satisfaction of their inheritance from God. And it's kind of like if you are in a river and you put something in the mouth of the river, the source of the river, is some type of pollutant, the entire river is going to be infected by that thing. It's just common knowledge. This is the very beginning of the history of Israel in the Promised Land. So what they do here is the most important thing. They're pouring things into the river of their history, and they don't even realize it. The actions that they're doing now will affect everything else that we're going to see today. The first pollutant, if you will, is this tolerating evil. This is different than actually sinning, though. It's as if you have something in your house that you shouldn't have. You're not actually using it. It's just kind of over there in the corner. The second thing that they did, though, is really what they didn't do. It's they forgot God. It says they forgot God. We see this in chapter 2, verse 10. Chapter 2, verse 10, these are the two things that were kind of the source, in my mind, of whatever else we see coming out. Verse 10 says this, when all the generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation rose up. So one whole group of people was gone, a new group of people came, and we get descriptions of them. It says, after him, then they did not know, it says two things, they did not know. And this is reminiscent of Psalm 150, right? They did not know the Lord. That's the capital L-O-R-D, the covenant, promise-making and keeping God. But they did not know also the things that he did. And so they forgot the Lord. Now, how does that happen? How do they forget the Lord? Well, either you got bad listeners, got bad teachers, or no teachers, right? I mean, got some teachers in the room right now. If the kids don't learn it, it may not be all your fault. It could be the student's fault. They just don't listen. It could be a poor teacher. The men or the leaders in Israel could be poor at conveying who God is and what he's done, but what my guess is, they just neglected to inform them and remind themselves of these amazing truths. So shining in the darkness is directly connected with tolerating evil, just allowing it to be close and near, but also neglecting the Lord in our lives. You know, when you combine these two things, it's kind of like a two-part epoxy. I don't know if you've ever seen or even heard of epoxy. It's a hardener. It's something that can hold things together just like Gorilla Glue, if you know what Gorilla Glue is. But there's two parts. When they're separated, they're very, very moldable. It's very soft. It's more just like a cream, if you will. But when you take these two things and you put them together, the combination is something that is so hard and it sticks so tightly to the things that it touches that it will only damage the objects if you try to remove it. All right, and at this point in Israel's history, those two things, when you combine them together, it's like that epoxy. It's adhering to them so tightly that if they were to try to remove it at this point, it would only cause damage and pain around them. And so the source, first of all, if we're going to be able to shine, we need to look at what their source was and then look at ourselves. We shine bright when we don't tolerate evil. Again, this is different than participating with it. It's just allowing it to float around you, be in existence around you. But we shine brightest also when we remind ourselves through prayer and praise and testimonies and preaching about who God is. We will lose our effectiveness to shine if we don't. Okay, that's the first key. Our second key, though, is avoiding the stages. Now, we get in verse 11 to 18. We don't have time to look at every verse, but I would do like a little bracket around those verses if I were you, and you can just put the word cycle, or put the word stages, because what we see here is the blueprint for the entire history of Israel, and what I want you to see is when you look at your own heart, you can find that you find yourself in the exact same stages. Throughout the book, there's a stage cycle that's repeated seven different times, and I'm gonna list them off for you, and then I'm gonna show them in chapter 3 a couple examples, and we're gonna unpack them in chapter 2. So really quick, if you will look at chapter 3, and if you write these down, you will not only understand this chapter more, but you will understand the whole book of Judges. Chapter 3, verse 7. So the first stage in this cycle of darkness is sin. You see that in verse 7 of chapter 3. They did evil. The second stage is going to be slavery. Look at verse 8. It says, the Lord sold them into the hand of the enemy. And then we see supplication or crying out to God. We see that in verse 9. It says, when the children of the Lord cried out. And then we see salvation. Deliverance. So it says, the Lord raised up a deliverer for the children of Israel who delivered them. So if you got those 4 points, sin, slavery, supplication, salvation, it's a pattern that's repeated throughout the whole book. And that means something for us because we find ourselves in the exact same thing. But when we look at chapter 2, there are things in each stage that will help us understand our walks with God better. And what is really happening in each one of these stages. And so if you're tracking with me, look at verse 11 one more time. This first stage is there are two things that the author of Judges wants us to know about their sin. And again, this chapter 2 is very much a blueprint. So it's kind of saying when you sin, at least these two things are happening. The first thing is verse 12, it says, they forsook God. So they're leaving a position where they once were. But then the second thing that's happening is that they are following something that is false. Sin, you can't sin without departing from God. You're close with him, and then you walk away. You're in close proximity of him. You experience his presence. And sin, the first aspect is removing yourself, causing distance between those two. But there's no spiritually neutral ground when we sin. We're not just leaving from God, we're going to something else. And it's just important to realize that they were going to a false god, something that is less valuable, something that is less real, less sustainable, and less satisfying. When we leave our walk with God, we are always downgrading. I don't know if you like steak, ribeye. The young pros, we love food. It's one of our favorite things that we do. We have whole days dedicated to just what food are we going to eat. And one of the things that we do, we want the best quality food, best tasting food, so we'll get people to look up recipes and get the absolute best because it's the most enjoyable, most satisfying, right? But what we typically don't do is let's do a, and forgive me of all you McDonald's lovers in the fan, or the crowd, but we don't do a whole day about McDonald's pies or McDonald's quarter pounder cheeseburgers. The French fries, that's a different story, okay? We can do a whole day, French fry, we'll do that next time. But what we don't do is we don't settle for less. It doesn't necessarily compute in so many areas of life. Why would you leave if you have the absolute best experience of anything? Why would you stoop for something that's so much lower? That's exactly what we see with Israel. Forsook God, followed something false that is not worth it, and you'll never be satisfied. When they sin, however, there's a consequence. That's where we get the second stage of slavery. And again, there's two things that we can see in the slavery. It had an effect, and there's two things that happened to them, and we can see it in our lives. Notice, first of all, the slavery meant that there would be things taken from them that they never wanted to be taken. So we get that in verse 14. It says, he delivered them into the hands of the plunderers who plundered or spoiled them. He sold them into the hands of their enemies all around them. So the first thing that happened is that they were sold into people, and what they did is the people took things that was theirs and they made it their own. All right, things that they possessed. Maybe it was gold. Maybe it was a statue of something. Maybe it was a family heirloom. Maybe it was a nice rug. I don't know what it was, but these people that when they gave into the sin, these people overcame them, God sold it into them, and the first thing that happened was they took things. I think sin has the same effect on us. It will always take things, take more than you ever thought it would take. It could be take your joy. It could be your contentment. It could be satisfaction, or it could be a relationship. Sin has a way of not just taking immaterial things, but literally physical things. How many people, you can just use pastors, for instance, have lost their jobs because of the sin that comes into their lives? It takes things that we never want it to take. So if we want to shine, we can't allow the sin to be tolerated and then to come in and be able to take things that God never intended for it to take. But the second thing, and this might be a little more appropriate for some of you that want to be involved in ministry, sin not only takes, but it prevents victory. Sin prevents victory. Look at verse 14. It says, he sold them into the hands of the enemies, so that they could no longer stand before them. So the exact result of allowing the sin to happen is that they couldn't have victory. At one point, they would fight and they'd win. All of a sudden, they're fighting and they're losing. And God says it's a result of the slavery that happened. And then the third thing is supplication. What we see here, this is just a crying out. The word groanings is mentioned in verse 18 of chapter 2. So we get this third stage of groaning. And this is powerful because the sin allowed their situation to get so bad that they needed to cry out to God in desperation. Now for us, we are just like our beautiful Palawan, I call her peanut butter princess, Leona. Our beautiful little girl. The moment that she is discomforted in any way, and there's typically two things that would cause her to be discomforted. The first reason is she did something that she shouldn't have. Namely, the binky was in her mouth and then spit it out. And I could go up to her and be like, what were you thinking? You knew you would not like that. You knew that would make you uncomfortable and upset. You should know better. I don't, thankfully. Maybe sometimes I think that, though. The second thing that they do that would cause them uncomfortable is maybe they eat some food, they really enjoy the food, but then they get rid of the food, if you know what I'm trying to say. And she's crying, and she's screaming, and she's saying, this needs to stop. Did we do anything wrong? No, actually, we did everything that we needed to help her to be a healthy and just successful human being. But what she does after that can cause her discomfort. But there is at least another end which could cause her to cry out to God, and we see this in our lives, not just when we do things that we shouldn't, but, man, when she is hungry or when she is nervous or scared, there's times when we'll put her down and she's like smiling and she's cooing. It's the cutest thing ever. We put her down and she screams. It's like, what is going on? And it's the sense of she thinks we're leaving. Even at just 2 months old, she already knows when mom and dad are far apart, because then it's like she can't see, even though we're only 5 feet away, but her eyes are so dim, she can't see far enough. So she'll be worried that we're too far. So whether it be the things that she does wrong, the things that we need to give her, she cries out. And Israel is the same way. They did things that they shouldn't have. That's what we've been looking at. But they need something that only God can give, and so they cry out to him. And if you think that believers don't get to this point in their lives of sinning and then being enslaved by their sin, all you have to do is ask yourself the one question, simply put, and it's legitimate, but can a believer be addicted to a sin? In other words, this idea of slavery, does that even happen to us? Well, simply put, Paul said in Romans chapter 7 that the thing which you commit yourself to, you become a servant of that thing. And he goes on to say, if you commit yourself to sin, you're a slave of that sin. But if you commit yourself to God, you're a slave to God, which just means you do what those things say. You do what those things say. Our fourth point, and we'll move on, is going to be salvation. And this is where we get in verse 16. So after they call out to God, immediately the next step is always God rescuing them. God rescuing them. We know in Romans 10, 13, it says, for whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. And believers who find themselves caught in maybe this cycle as well, all you have to do is go to 1 John 1:9, and it says, if we, again, the we, that's John is writing the book, he's an apostle, so he's talking about believers. If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us of our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. So we got the stage set up for the rest of the book. We got the four parts of this cycle. But some people get trapped in this cycle, kind of like the hockey player who gets trapped in a penalty box. I would have you raise your hand if you are a hockey fan. In fact, are there any hockey fans? Ooh, I forgot. There's at least, okay, I've got three. That was three more than the last service. You guys are doing great. Which is okay. I can't say I'm a hockey fan, because I don't watch hockey. But I am a Blackhawks fan, but they haven't been in the Stanley Cup in a long time, so ergo, maybe I'm not a hockey fan. But the penalty box is something unique to hockey, where if you do something wrong, you break the rules, the referee has to escort you personally to this designated place outside the rink. Now, what that means is you can still watch the game. You can still observe what's going on. Being in the penalty box means you can still dress like the team. You can still look like the team. You wear the jersey. You don't have to take it off. You can still hold your stick. Also, you can cheer the team on, but what you cannot do is participate in any way of the success of the team. That's what the penalty box is for. You are penalized, which means your influence is removed. Israel found themselves in this penalty box. They could still look like God's people. They could still act like God's people. and they could still cheer and want God to be lifted up and exalted, but their influence was gone. I don't know if you've felt the weight of losing influence in someone's life. The idea of losing respect. You felt like you had it, and it's gone. It's devastating. Absolutely devastating. There's something hardwired into humans. We want, and even to function well, need respect. I want to be careful about saying that, but respect and having influence is just so ingrained in us. And so for us, may we not allow this cycle to infect us to the point where we are not able to have that influence, where that penalty box is not affected anymore. We want to be in the game. We want to allow our team to win. We want to see the kingdom just advanced. But the third thing, not just the stages, but we see that we need to affirm the severity of the darkness. Affirm the severity. All right, so we know where it came from. Tolerating evil. They put things into the lives and the history of Israel that just affected everything else. We know the stages. We know that these stages happened at least seven times. I'm going to say it happened more than that. But notice verse 19 of chapter 2. How bad was it? If you look at verse 19 of chapter 2, it says this. It says, it came to pass when the judge was dead. So all these judges raised up, and as soon as they die, something happens. It says, the people reverted back to what they did before, and it says, they behaved, underline the phrase, more corruptly. More corruptly. All that means is that after round one of this cycle, round two was worse. After round two of this cycle, round three was worse. Four, five, six, there was 13 judges. There's at least 13 rounds of this, which means round 13 was pretty bad. All right? And if you don't believe me, just read Judges chapters, 19 to 21. It is the lowest point of the Bible. Not even close. It's the lowest point. Some of the things will make your stomach hurt if you know what it means by what it says. And so how severe was it and what caused that severity? I think there's three kind of categories of the people that got worse, and we can think about them really quick. The leaders progressively got worse. So consider Deborah. She's in chapter 4. She's the third judge used. If you want to do a study on just awesome people, Deborah. If you want to do a study on awesome women, you can't do a proper survey of the most godly women in the Bible, most influential, and just ones that you can just learn a lot from without Deborah. It's hard to find anything she did wrong, okay? I'm sure she did, but kind of like Joseph, I don't know if there's much written that she did wrong. Fast forward to Samson, the last one mentioned. It is hard to find anything he did right. Mistake after mistake after mistake. The only thing he did that God told him to do was he didn't cut his hair. I was like, is that even like a righteous thing? Or did you just like the way that, you know, you look like Thor? Like, is that why? Like, what was the real reason why you didn't cut your hair? Because that's the only thing that you didn't do. It's hard to find anything that Samson did. So the leadership just progressively got worse. And that has a profound effect on a group of people. Maybe the only thing that could affect a group of people more is not just who's leading, but how are they worshiping? The quality and the content of our worship determines so much of who we are as people, which is why we love worshiping in music, we love worshiping in our work, we love worshiping in our family, but how we worship, the word worship just means what you find worth in. How worthy is God for you, and how are you going to show that in your life? And what we see in chapter 2 is it says they bowed down to, it says, one group of gods. It says the Baals. That's not good. I'm not recommending worshiping Baals. But what I am saying is that is nothing compared to what it says at the end, which you can count them off. It says not only did they worship Baals, but chapter 10, verse 6, it says that they had worshiped seven different gods. It says, the Baals, the Asherahs, the gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the people of Mon, and the gods of the Philippines. Well, Philippines. They probably didn't worship the god of the Philippines. Maybe they did. Maybe the Philistine god is the Philippine god. I can't say definitively. I'm going to go with no, though. So the god of the Philistines was the seventh one mentioned. Philippines would be eight. There we go. But what we see is, man, their worship just got worse. They wanted to run from God in, instead of one direction, seven different directions. They stooped not for one terrible meal, but for seven different types of terrible meals. They were settling for this second-class life with God, and they just didn't care. And then the third thing, that's going to affect leadership, affects worship. Worship affects the character of people. What happens in the lives of the people near the beginning of the book is nothing compared to what happens in the lives of people near the end. And for the sake of time, I'll let you look that up later. I won't illustrate that. But the people, just the non-leaders, what were the conduct like? It just got worse. And you know, it's helpful for us to think about this and just to truly just affirm it. Recognize that our sin tends to be worse than what we think. Our sin tends, and the sin around us, it tends to be more severe than we want to admit. If we're not careful, we can be fake ID Christians, right? What's a fake ID? A fake ID is simply a piece of paper or plastic that makes it seem like you're someone you're not. Typically, the whole purpose of a fake ID is to make someone young appear to be older. Although I'm sure there have been people who were older who wanted people to think that they were younger, and that's happened, I'm sure. But another reason why fake IDs are sometimes used is to allow yourself to have access to certain places, to get into certain people, groups, different locations, businesses, whatever it may be. These IDs allow you to have acceptance or access with certain people. And I think if you're like me, you're tempted to not bring out Guam, you have your real ID, right? You're tempted to not bring out who you really are, but you want to reach into your pocket and you got this fake image of what you want people to think you are. Want people to think maybe you don't talk a certain way or you do talk a certain way. Maybe you don't lose your patience in a certain way, but you actually do. Maybe you don't struggle with certain things, but you actually do on a regular basis. Whatever it might be, we are so tempted to just bring out these fake IDs and make it seem like we're something that God never intended us to be. And I wonder, why is that such a strong thing for us? Why do we struggle so much with just not being real? Why is it so hard to just be transparent and honest of where we're at? Because what they did is they were never honest about them. If they were, they wouldn't have fallen into the same cycle again, again, and again, and again. Their problem, it was not that they didn't call on God, because they did. It's that they didn't learn from the times when they fell, then lead to calling on God. So it's never an issue of just don't sin in life, right? Like, that can't be the application. Just don't sin. Like, well, great. This meant nothing to me because I will sin. The question is how you respond when, how quickly you return to God, and what are you going to be learning from when you fall? So may we not struggle with this fake ID Christianity. May we just be transparent and honest and sincere about how severe the sin really is. At this point, you've probably felt the weight of Israel and you don't feel good, right? It's kind of like when you're watching a movie or you're reading a book and it goes from bad to worse to worse to worse, and it's like you're getting angry, but at the same time, sometimes those stories are what are the most compelling because it is so hard and things are so bad. You're like, how could it ever get better? How could it ever change? Well, God is the greatest storyteller of all time, and not only was he in control of everything in the sense of he wasn't causing these things to happen, but allowing them for a purpose. He allowed them to get to this point where they were desperately lost in their sin to get them to the point of recognizing what the true solution of the darkness is. So our last point is me understanding what is their solution to the darkness, which is for us going to be our solution. And there's a phrase that's repeated. Look in chapter 17, verse 6, really quick. And we'll see it in chapter 18, 19, and 21. And I think my controller is dead. So you guys want to skip to the next slide for me. Chapter 17, verse 6, it says this. We read it earlier, but it's important to realize that this is, in the author's mind, the problem. It says in verse 6, in those days, there is no king in Israel. Chapter 18, verse 1, next chapter. In those days, there was no king. Chapter 19, verse 1, it came to pass in those days when there was no king. And of course, chapter 21, verse 25, we see that it says, in those days, there was no king. What do you think in the author of Judges' mind was the number one problem for them? It wasn't their choir. It wasn't the people. The author knew their problem was, who is ruling us? Who is in control of the direction of God's people? So our solution, just like them, is going to be the righteous king of God's people. So when we see ourselves with the source, when we see ourselves in the stages, when we see the severity, what do we do? How do we get out of that? How do we break these cycles? What do we do about the situation we find ourselves in? In the same sense of when we come for salvation is how we navigate our sanctification as believers. And so what we need is a king who deals with sin. Romans 5:19 puts it as clearly as any passage, where it just says, as by one man's disobedience, Adam's, many were made sinners, so also by one man's obedience, Jesus, many will be made righteous. Jesus doesn't just pay for sin in a temporary sense where you get off a little bit, but then you have to pay interest later. It permanently deals with it. But also someone who can liberate from slavery. We talked about how believers do have the potential to go back and have sin control them. John 8 affirms that if you have been set free by the Son, you shall be free indeed. In Galatians 4:8, it says this. This is just a beautiful passage. So in your margins or on your notes, if you take any notes, just write Galatians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9. It says, you are no longer a slave. I think it would be great at some point just pause and sing about that. And there's plenty of songs that talk about this, that we are absolutely no longer a slave to any sin in our lives because of the freedom that we get and the liberation that we get from Jesus. But it says, you're no longer a slave, but you're a son. And if a son, you're an heir of God through Christ. He says, but then indeed, when you did not know God, you served those by which, by nature, are not gods. And it says, why, after you have known God, or rather have become known by God, is it that you turn again to the weak and the beggarly elements to which you are freed from? We need this king who is able to liberate us ultimately and completely from our sin. We need a king who answers and then offers prayer. Not only is he the one we call on to, but Jesus, it says in Hebrews 7:25, it says, consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. Jesus is this king who not only frees us, but he intercedes for us. And then we need a king. If you remember in Judges, there's a phrase that's repeated about the judges being controlled or being moved by the Spirit of God. Seven times is actually mentioned that the ruler had success because he was moved by the Spirit. John 3:34 talks about Jesus, his relationship to the Holy Spirit in this way. He says, "For he whom God has sent," that's Jesus, "speaks the words of God, for God does not give him the Spirit without measure." Meaning he had an immeasurable amount of the Spirit, immeasurable amount of the influence of the Spirit flowing through him, and we need to turn to him through then. And then, of course, the judges, their difficulty was they had success when they were alive, but when they died, they were reverted back. The ruler dies, and the people fall. Our ruler, our king, never dies. Romans 6:9, it says this, and then we'll conclude. It says this, "For we know that Christ, being raised from the dead, will never die again," which means his rule in your heart, the security of your salvation, the hope of your future, also will never die. Because Jesus is our living hope. We look to him as the source and the substance of our hope. And so in conclusion, with this idea about how can we practically shine in darkness, we looked at Israel and how they failed to use these keys. We can look at ourselves and how we can flourish by using these keys. And I think we can conclude with just a picture of a lighthouse. The darkest of nights doesn't automatically mean we will shine. That just means the light will be able to shine brighter. An effective lighthouse, it does three things. And I don't know where this is at, but man, talk about a good view. What we see in a lighthouse is, first of all, a lighthouse will signal that there is rest and there is peace, and there is safety close by. There is rest, there is peace, and there is safety close by. A lighthouse also gives directions on how to navigate. That's why it doesn't just point out, it circles around and around to be able to show what type of land is around it and to show there's ocean and there's land. Avoid this. And then the third thing is just it warns about coming danger. So for us to shine, I think as a church and individuals, man, when you got people who are coming in, we affirm and we want to show them that there is rest and that there is peace close by. Jesus said it, that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. We have the king in us, we have the message of the king, and we have the spirit of the king motivating us. If people are wandering and they need direction, we should have the confidence to direct them to the king and to the nature of the kingdom. And finally, if they are carelessly going about their life, again, have the courage to warn about the coming danger. And so as we want to shine, we want to have those influences. As we shine, as we long to look at what did they do, how can we learn better? This, again, will set us up well, I think, for feeling the weight of Ruth. Again, Ruth, the whole point of this next series is going to be understanding no matter what happens, no matter how dark it gets, one, God is in control. Number two, God is reaching out and redeeming people for him. Namely, he's going into a Gentile land to redeem a bride for him, and that's us. So may we shine brightly in these dark times.